But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Right. Hello, everybody. Hello, hello, and welcome to another installment of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. Mike, how you doing down there in the sweet state of Georgia?
Well, I looked outside, Scotty. We seem to have a little less snow than you guys up there in New Jersey.
We got
more than zero. Am I correct?
That's correct. A little, slightly more than zero.
Okay, so you won the snow making competition. Congratulations.
Yep, undefeated. Undefeated.
Mm.
But
people up in Buffalo are like, hold my beer. But still.
But yes, welcome back to the show, or if this is your first time listening, I am Scott, and that is Mike, and we are verbal. I like that you just wave to the proverbial audience that is not.
You never know. I mean, maybe one day you'll accidentally put up one of our videos up, and the fans are like, oh, Mike recognized us.
That Mike's a real swell guy. He always acknowledges us, never ignores us.
No.
Scott, on the other hand, he doesn't care about us. He doesn't wave to us.
His hand was stationary, ladies and gentlemen. It did not move once.
He's like a hockey player. He doesn't like acknowledge anybody, you know, like very impersonal. But we are Verbal Shenanigans, and each week we try to do this here, this thing where we interview interesting guests and talk about life and just kind of whatever else pops up. I know most of you probably heard us Wednesdays at noon on what the hell is it called again? What the hell is that?
Coming right up.org.
That's what I missed. I almost said the Coming Right Up County. I just mixed two places you could hear us. But we are now on the comingrightup.org every Wednesday at 12 o'clock. So if you're in your cubicle and you're kind of bored and you want to get more bored, throw our show on. Or, Mike, we are also located on the Discover County Network.
Discovery County Network, their internet radio and their podcast network we're on. So.
Yeah. And
we're out there.
Yeah, the last 2 weeks have been really cool too. If you guys like what you hear today, last 2 weeks we had two totally different interviews, I guess we could say. Last week was the one and only Vermin Supreme, Mike. Vermin Supreme.
Yeah, I checked
your vote.
You're kind of low. Still not trending. I mean, I went on CNN and Fox News, and they're keeping them down, but. I know the underground roots are going to bring him back up.
Listen. We live in a world where Donald Trump is president. You know, whatever. It was fine. You know, some millionaire. We live in a world where, you know, anything can go viral at any second. So Vermin Supreme, he just needs to insult the right person or glitter bomb Trump or, you know, hit Bernie Sanders with a pony or something like that. And he will gain steam. People will vote for him.
Yeah. He's very anti the socialist pony network. Pro pony. And then that socialist pony crap where the rich people got to give the poor people all their ponies.
Yeah.
Both. Or they got to earn them ponies.
Or split those ponies in pieces and give some to the poor, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But,
yeah, so we had Vermin Supreme on last week. I don't really know how to explain him. Just go check him out. He's a unique character. And then before that, we had John Walsh from America's Most Wanted and his son Callahan on. So it's been a couple good weeks here.
Very similar guests last few weeks.
So. And we've had a whole laundry list of guests. So if you don't like us, please make sure to go check out some of our guests. Go in our archives. There's some impressive ones. And So, Mike, if I know. Years ago, we were looking on the message boards at one of our on one of our podcasts, and I think they what did they call us? The Lisp and what were you? The retarded brother or something like that?
Yeah, I think that was that was our underground, you know, original name of the show.
Right.
Yeah. We never figure out who was the lisp and who was the other guy.
So. Well, I mean, assuming I'm the lisp, I am telling you that today it might stand out even more because I can't feel my mouth. We even just conducted an interview where most of the time I was kind of splashing my cheeks together to see if it would help this a lot amount of Novocaine that is in my mouth right now, which is this is the worst feeling ever. Like I had to go to the dentist today for the third
time.
Which
you hate.
Which is my, like, the bane of my existence. So, of course, I go after many, many, many years, and I got to go back. I had to go back three times, so that was fun. Couple cavities, so couple bonding.
Perfect condition, and the dentist just said, "Keep coming back. I love seeing this."
Yeah, she was just like, "You're too attractive to not come back." So we're just gonna.
Yeah, I'm gonna invite some friends over, some fellow dentists, so we can just all just stare and glow at you.
How did you know? That was exactly the scenario that was.
Well,
happening.
Why else would you go to a dentist? I mean, come on. Like every time I sit down in a dentist chair, I'm like, bring out my audience. It's time to gaze into my mouth.
Okay. Now, so I am up until like an hour ago, I was really bad. I went to eat and I made like rice and steak and I still couldn't feel my mouth. And I'm like putting rice in my mouth, but I... The rice is just going to the sides of my teeth, so it's just like filling up on the sides, and I'm not feeling it there. And then I went to speak, like it's just shooting out. I got it in my beard; it's dribbling down my face. Disastrous. It was even worse when I immediately got home. I was starving. I made this little peanut butter and jelly, like just a, like a sandwich thin, like a little bit. And I go to bite it. I can't even feel the bite, and there's this jelly all over my face, and I kind of can't taste it. Everything is just a disaster.
Yeah, it's the worst going through that. No, I mean, number one, it's pretty dangerous. They actually say, like, I had to get, like, a really big root canal, and the doctor said, like, you can't eat for an hour. If you try to eat within the next hour, you could, like, bite into your tongue, and you wouldn't know it, and bite off your tongue, so... That's pretty dangerous.
Damn shame that didn't happen to you.
I'll show you.
That'd be one.
Enjoy this hot pocket.
That'd be one way. That'd be one way to get rid of you on the show. Oh damn! Mike bit his tongue off. I guess it's co-host auditions.
Yeah. I get top billing on the show now, Scotty.
Imagine you trying to do accents. With no tongue.
Berlu, how's it still Russian? I don't even understand what's coming out of it. It still went there. It's amazing.
I'm just now starting to feel a little bit. Like, my lips don't feel like they're moving right, but before it was really bad, I almost had to cancel on you tonight because I was like, well, I can't talk. This whole podcast thing involves talking, you know? Like, I can't just get by my amazingly good looks, but...
Well, you should just wave like I do.
I got a pretty interesting story while I was at the dentist today, but I want to reconnect with you because you're starting the breakup, so I'm just going to hang up and call back. We are calling Berlu. Reconnecting.
Yes.
Oh, there you are. See, you already sound better. Yeah, I don't know why that is. It's like the sound starts to slowly decay, like an old record. Of course, no dentist. I'm finally getting out of the weeds. I had a, 2 weeks ago I had to go to, and they, like, for those of you who don't know, I've told a lot of dental stories on this podcast over the years, but I've had a lot of problems, knocked teeth out of my mouth, blah, 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 broke the same tooth a bunch of times, have bondings, have teeth put back in. So my front teeth are were the bane of my existence growing up, and I really grew to hate dentists and kind of, not even the dentist themselves, but more of the experience and the... And you know how it is when you put something off, you kind of build it more up in your mind, how it's worse and worse and worse, than it really might be. But anyway, so I had broken these teeth and had all these work done. And so last week they went in and like stripped them down to like the old bondings and built all like three teeth back up. So that was a little painful for a couple of days. But today was just cavities, right? So I had three cavities to do. So, you know, she blasted me full of Novocaine the first two times and I'm still feeling it. So she's like, "You feel it?" I'm like, yeah. So she feels me more, takes care of the one side. And I'm like, all right. And she's like, "Well, you know, you got one little one on the other side. You can come back again. We'll do that. Or we can get it done today." And I'm like, and Mike, I actually thought of us. It was, you know, but it was around 4:30, 5 o'clock-ish. I'm like, oh, man, I got a podcast tonight. Like, I can't feel my one side of my face. Now they're going to do the other one. Like, I'm going to be like, but I'm like, you know what? I even said to her, I thought about it. I said, you know, I like you a lot, Doc, but I don't want to see you again anytime soon. I've came back three times, so let's just get it done. So she's like, okay, well, I can numb more like just the one tooth than the whole like side of your face. And I'm sitting there like, why would you do that to every tooth if that was an option? Yeah. Like, why would you just like to see one side of my face, like Bell's palsy face? Like,
well, we just like to show off here at the dentist's office, you know.
Look how great our drugs are.
But we're like, let me show you something. You just crank it right in there.
Look how awesome our drugs are. They're the best. Top of the line face numbers here. So she does it and wait around, and, you know, Novocaine sets in. And she's like doing her thing. She starts the, you know, the whole drilling and whatnot, and it's going fine. And then she like takes out a drill and like starts to go into my tooth, and it must have hit a nerve or the root or something in my tooth. And I, you know, it's not really a thought. You know, it's not really a thought. It's a flinch, a reaction. Like, you know, nerves in your teeth are a whole other thing. It's like there's no thinking of how you react to that. So I must have reacted like. And when I did that, I must have knocked the drill out of her hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the drill lands in my tongue.
Nice. So you have a nice piercing for us now.
Here's the weird thing. So I'm sitting there, and she's like, ooh, ooh, ooh. And you hear her like, ooh. And then you hear the assistant like, oh, ha, ha. Like, you know, everyone's kind of in this like, oh, shit. Like, and I feel it like stuck to my tongue. And I can't really feel much of anything, but I feel the, you know, the weight of the drill in there. I'm like, eh. And she like, and she like takes it off. And I thought it had gone right in because it was stuck. Like, it was stuck, and I thought I was going to be, like, bleeding out. And the first thought in my head is, like, oh, God, I'm going to have to, like, get some kind of, a stitch or two in my tongue or something like that. And I don't know if it was bleeding, but she was like, oh, my God. She's like, what happened? Like, where did you feel anything? I'm sitting there like, did I feel anything? Like, no, I just wanted to see. My buddy bet me $10.
It's a fun thing I like to do. It's a practical joke show, and I like to get that drill right in my tooth. I'm like, hold on.
Yeah. My buddy Mike bet me on the podcast that I could have knocked a drill out of a dentist's hand. 10 points, Scott.
We call this dentist rodeo.
So, and even she goes, oh, man. She's like, and I was like, ooh, because I got like a little sweaty. Like, I don't know. It's like my nervous reaction. Like, oh, man. Like, because I thought my tongue was like blasted apart. And she's like, oh, man. She's like, yeah, that made my back sweat. That's what she said. I'm like, oh, good. You know, like, and so she goes back and, like, fixes the tooth. And she's like, oh, let me check your tongue out. And she's like, She's like, I guess it didn't, like, pierce it. But she's like, which I don't really know. It was stuck there. I'm like, I know. And she's like, I don't really see anything. And she's like, I was really nervous because, like, we didn't numb your tongue. So she's like, you know, like, she's like, I thought you were going to be, like, really in pain. And I'm like, I wasn't. I felt it there. But what's weird now is I'm starting to feel, like, as I'm talking to you in, like, the last 10, 15 minutes, like, one spot on my tongue that feels, like, sore. Like, I feel like maybe it went in and it just didn't bleed. I don't know. But weird, dude. It wouldn't be the dentist for Scott Brennan if there wasn't some kind of traumatic experience to not want to go back the next time.
Yeah. I mean, number one, anytime somebody says you made my back sweat, that's a story.
Right.
No, nobody says you made my back sweat and it was just another boring day at the office.
Right. So. You know, and here's a woman that's probably, you know, done 3 million tooth things. And, like, if that's the first time she's ever seen that, of course it's when Scott Brennan is in the chair.
Yeah. Another thing, it's kind of weird. It's like you could have just done each individual tooth. You decide to numb up half your side of your mouth,
right.
But you also turn around and said, "Nah, not touching the tongue.
Yeah.
Nah, not gonna do it. I don't want to show off too much."
This is a game we like to play called Novocaine Roulette.
Double zero, you're in trouble.
Double zero means left side.
Better hope I hold on to this drill. You really should.
It's Novocaine Twister. Let's spin it. Oh, you got right side of face blue. Oh, and just individual tooth
left
yellow.
Red.
So it's just like, you know, something I hate and took all my, like, courage is not the word to use, because I didn't do anything. I'm not like a hero here, but I did something that, like, for me was conquering, like, a fear that I've kind of been building up in a while. And then, of course, something kind of crazy happens, and it's like, well, you know, Scott, it's just the story of my life, but I'm here. You know, I guess since I'm so extreme, Mike, maybe, you know, today's guests are both pretty extreme also. We got two guests on the show. I think we should get to the first one. This one's interesting. I guess, you know,
this one's for us. Yeah. We got to admit this, audience.
But you know what? You know what? Like, I was thinking about this earlier. I was out running, and I was thinking that all these episodes kind of started, I, you know, all the guests and all the little journey we've been on have all started from trying to get one guest on for us, and that was Paul Templer, the hippo attack survivor.
That's true.
So that all started from a stupid bit I was writing, which I haven't done in a long time. I need to do. And I was trying to get Paul Templer. We're like, oh, let's call a hippo attack guy, and we were in a car driving to some gig or something like that, and I called and, like, left a message or whatever, and he ended up calling in the middle of while I was working, and I basically ignored his call. And if he didn't leave a voicemail, probably would have never called back because of some weird, like, Detroit number. and that really honestly spawned, like, oh, crap, we can get, like, a lot of guests on this show, like, interesting guests. And I would say that started the idea of guests, and then Marcelo Balboa started the idea of getting, like, actual, like, names on the show.
Yeah. As for Paul Templer and all, I think my favorite part is still how we figured, okay, he's not calling us back, and we ripped on him. And then he left a message where he's like, yeah, I'm interested in the show. And he kind of said, I heard what you said about me the week before. It was our good first foot in there. And all. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of other guests that we did just for us. Kazuki James, aka Kazpop.
Yeah, just for you. Yeah.
No, that was you.
Right, just for you.
Towards me. No. When I say you, I'm talking about you.
Listen, I know you guys don't like probably do a lot of talking, but you know, he's a man pup, so you want to get the behind the scenes story of him.
Yeah, that's what happened. Sure.
But who we got today? Well, we'll kind of talk about why this all. I honestly don't remember the origin of this. I do remember making jokes just about every week that probably not one listener understands.
The best I can recall, this was in between my jobs when I was
that's what I
let
remember.
Go from my company, and then you came up with your big list of possible jobs I can get into, and then it just seems like both of us were infatuated with snake milking.
Right. And then somehow it turned into Burlew snake milk. Come on, get Burlew snake milk. It's the best thing for your heart.
Pending.
So I guess, who we got?
Well, we got Jim Harrison, Scott. He is the director.
Former Steeler, good linebacker.
No, that's James Harrison. I couldn't, he won't return our calls. Plus, he's pretty scary, so I don't want to interrupt him.
I'm not sure anybody's scarier than Psycho Sid, though. So at this point, bring it on. I want to talk to everybody. Because Psycho Sid has the look of a person that will track you down.
That's true. That's true. And sometimes we wonder if Lenny Dykstra will.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to get into him in a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But tonight we're having Jim Harrison. He is the director of the Kentucky Reptile Zoo. And we're going to be talking to him about their zoo itself with all their different reptiles, the tours that they do. And yes, we're going to get into snake milking.
All right. Well, just another day on Verbal Shenanigans here. Let's give Jim a call.
Well, Jim, thank you for giving us some time here on Verbal Shenanigans. Are you calling us from the farm, the zoo right now itself, or are you at home?
Well, the home is on the property, and we've been cleaning mud because there was a flood on the zoo property. I don't know if you've seen the news, but Kentucky's got like a state of emergency for the whole state. So got a little bit of water.
Oh, geez. Well, I hope everything's okay over there.
Yeah, everything's fine. It's just a lot of cleaning up and a lot of, you know, a lot of mud. So,
So Jim, just to give you a little background on our show and all, like we have different celebrities and athletes and interesting guests, and we had kind of had a bit on here when I was in between jobs before I moved down here to Georgia about certain things, and Scott brought up the job of snake milking. So we kind of got a little obsessed with this notion. So you're probably going to get 90% of your questions about this. I got to be frank with you right now.
Okay, that's fine. Well, I will point out that we don't sit on a stool and we don't milk like you milk a cow. we actually call it extracting. So, but everybody... The general public calls it a milker, but it's not quite what it is.
That's awesome. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about I know you're the director of the zoo. What's the history of the Kentucky Reptile Zoo, and how'd you come part of it?
Well, I founded it. It's a nonprofit organization, and we house between 1,600 to 2,000 venomous snakes on ground. And our main purpose is to do education and provide venom for medical research. Some of the venom is used for anti-venom, but a lot of it's used in research for cancer. Also projects looking for replacing opiates with neuron transmission type venoms that are like block the transmitters and neurons and stuff. So it's, you know, I set the zoo up. Actually, this will be our 29th year here, wow. But I've been extracting venom for 43 years. I started right out of high school. I was like 18, just barely 18 when I started extracting. First snake I extracted from were king cobras. So,
How does that even start? Like you're 18, you're like, oh, I need a job. I could work at the food store. I could work.
I've never really received. I don't get compensation for doing it. I live off a small pension from the police department when I got run over by a stolen car when I was 26 years old. So I'm more afraid of humans than I am of snakes. But how I got started was I caught a snake when I was 6 years old and saw how the adults overreacted, and then by the time I was 12, I was reading on college level in herpetology, studying reptiles and amphibians. And then when I was 16, I went down to Florida and wrestled alligators for a while. And I met Dr. Sherman Minton from Indiana, who was a toxicologist and a herpetologist. And he got me interested in venoms. And then I met a researcher who was doing some research on brain activity effects of king cobra venom. So he asked me if I would do it, and I started out like maybe 50 king cobras that I was working with, and I'd extract from them every 2 weeks. And so it was, you know, that's how I got basically started in that part of it, and I just kept going. You know, when I graduated from high school, I decided I was going to take a trip to South America, and I hitchhiked. And then I found out, because we didn't have Wikipedia then, that the Panamanian Highway ends in Panama. So I was kind of like stuck and had to get on a boat and go. Ended up in Colombia. And it was the scariest thing, though, was actually in Arkansas when I got into a car with somebody who had a bunch of religious paraphernalia. in the car. And first I thought it'd be safe, and then I realized the guy was talking to somebody who wasn't in the car. Luckily it was on my way back, and I had a rattlesnake in the knapsack, and it rattled, and he says, "What's that?" And I said, "It's a rattlesnake," and he pulled off the road. So I don't know if I got out of the car from a serial killer or what it was, obviously that was more dangerous than all the drug cartel people I ran into in Colombia.
I got to admit, your story's a tad bit better than me just saying in my teens I went to community college. You got a little bit of advantage on me, Jim. Yeah. I got to be honest with you.
I paid my way through college kickboxing. So I would actually travel to places like South America and fight. And if I didn't get knocked out, I'd go snake hunting afterwards. So...
You sound like a fictional character, Jim. Like you went.
I know that. I was on to tell the truth, and they didn't know what to do with me. They're so used to BSers and stuff, and I'm like, you know, I have all the proof of all the scars to prove everything. I've been stabbed. I've been run over by a car. I've been hit in the head with a baseball bat. When I was a police officer, I got a car bumper went through my right leg, and I made it to 55 years old before I had to have my hip replaced. But I don't know if that was from the car accident. It probably was because my foot was facing the opposite direction. But I've been actually clinically dead 4 times in my life. So I've been rough on my body. But the one thing that people notice when they see pictures of me, they notice I'm missing the index finger of my right hand. And everybody thinks that's from a snake bite. That was from a cheap weightlifting bench. I dropped my weights on my finger and I crushed the joint. And they put a plastic joint in, and I actually busted it. Because I still train in kickboxing, I busted the plastic joint. So the guy who was working out with me goes, who happened to be a doctor, goes, "Well, you got to need to go back to the hand surgeon. I could actually spin my finger around in circles." So I went back and they could fuse it. And I'm like, "Well, if you fuse it, I'm going to stick it in something's mouth." So I went ahead and had it amputated, and I brought it home in a bottle of formaldehyde, and I had it in my lab. And one of my students that got a job at the Baltimore Aquarium ended up taking the finger, and I didn't know it. And I started getting pictures in the mail of my finger at different zoos all over the place with a fingerprint on the back saying, "Wish we were still attached." And it ended up at Anne Rice's Halloween party. So I have pictures of people dressed like the characters from the Interview with a Vampire holding my finger.
You know, and it would really suck if you got, like, found guilty of a crime with, like, your fingerprints on it.
Somebody could use my finger for that purpose. Yep, it would be bad. But it ended up disappearing at Anne Rice's Halloween party, so we assume it's in somebody's necklace someplace.
So let me get this straight. Just to recap for our audience, we talked to you for four minutes. You kickboxed your way to Ford.
Hitchhiked to South America.
to take care of snakes. You lost your finger. You had a weight bench fall on you. You were
a
police officer.
Out of a car, the possible serial killer.
Yeah.
I don't know how you made us forget about snake milking, but good job, sir.
It's all over the place, man. But, you know, the whole thing with the extraction of the venoms and stuff is just it's something I've done all my whole life. You know, it's what I do. I mean, when people interview me and stuff, they always expect me to be, like, either super scientific or they don't know what to think of me. One time when we were on National Geographic, the producer was like, "You're HBO special type person," he explained later, man, that I was too dark at that time for the regular TV. So I have a dark sense of humor because I worked in a coroner's office in high school and college and assisted on autopsies. So, and I grew up, on Monty Python. So I have a very you know, dark humor. So, but
I feel like your life story is a weird version of Forrest Gump. Like it's a very.
So if you have any questions about Extraction, guide me and I will answer you.
Jesus Christ. I have a lot of questions in general. I guess zoo-wise and animal-wise, you said you were studying animals from an early age, but did you own a lot of reptiles? Did you actually?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had snakes, and I made the mistake of, you know, when I was young, I almost blew it because my dad was very supportive and stuff, and he played semi-pro baseball, so we kind of, in the farm league, so we went all over the South playing ball, so I got the snake hunt all over the place. And I had a snake in an aquarium, and I told him it was a water snake, and it was actually a cottonmouth, or what people call a water moccasin. And he looked at one of my field guides, and he figured it out, and I didn't know whether to tell him I was lying or I made a mistake on identification. So I just let him think I made a mistake on identification. There would never be any more snakes in the house. So, that lasted until I traded some animals with an animal dealer in Florida when I was like 17, and I got a king cobra in return, and he didn't tell me what he was shipping me. He just said he was shipping me a snake in trade, and I opened it up in my bedroom, and it was a small bedroom with a bunk bed, and the king cobra chased me around the room. And Mom opened up the door. She goes, "What's going on?" I said, "Close the door." And she goes, "You don't talk to me like that." And I'm like, "If you don't close the door, you're dead." And she closed the door. And then later she told me, you know, the snake's gone or you're gone. So I shipped the snake out west, and it ended up in a really bad movie called, it was made back in, God, the 90s or 80s. I can't remember when it was made. It was a really bad movie about snake. Some guy injecting himself with venom and turning himself into a snake. It was really bad.
Wow, I still can't digest that entire story right there. I won't try. So, I guess my first question, when you're doing this process and all, when you're taking venom out of their system, and what is like the general length of time to do this, and about how much ounces or whatever do you get out of the snake?
We measure it by dried weight because we do so many snakes. Sometimes I average about 600 to 1,000 venom extractions a week. And that's some it. Days I'll do 200 to 300 venomous snakes in one day. And so one snake extraction takes 30 seconds to a minute if everything goes smoothly.
Oh. And is there any particular breed that's either A, easier, or B, the worst?
Yeah, that's a question everybody asks, and I try to use a mentality of never underestimating my opponent. And so I don't try to look at it quite that way. Some of the really actually the harder snakes for me to do are the little tiny, smaller snakes because of all the damage to my hands. I don't have arthritis, but I have some fused bones in my hand. So the little snakes like soft scale vipers and stuff like that are a little more difficult. Black mambas, king cobras, those are not that hard. King cobras are probably the easiest.
All right, so let's say Mike chose this career path, and he was like, yeah, you know, like this is the one for me. After talking to Jim, I feel like I want to kickbox and also milk snakes and just follow Jim around. And let's say it was his first day on the job, and, you know, you taught him his background. What are you starting with, and what kind of skill set does someone need to even attempt to do this job?
You know, the first skill set that I look for is the person who doesn't want to do it.
Oh, because all right. Mike, so far, so good.
Yeah, the person who doesn't want to do it isn't doing it for their ego. And, you know, all kidding aside, ego kills so fast that, you know, people make mistakes because they're showing off. And so, you want, if you're going to do it, you have to be focused on what you're doing, and you can't do anything else. And you also have to be willing to not make very much money. If, you know, if you have, like, I get 20% of a pension from the police department, and that's what I live off of.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't take a salary from the zoo or from the Venom. Everything goes back into the zoo and to the research. So as far as if you wanted to do it, you would have to want to live a very Spartan lifestyle, and you would have to be very focused. And focus is the most important thing. Mm. You can't go in there, and if you have a bad day, you don't get to erase it. It marks you permanently. You know, the 11 times I've had accidents, they've all left some kind of mark. You know, either I've been on life support, you know, 7 times I've been on life support, I've had my heart stop 3 times. You know, it has an effect on your body.
What is the love of it? Is it to eventually help people? Is it the thrill?
The reason I do it is that I want to contribute something back to society. Most people just want to sit around and, you know, take from society. I want to give something back. I don't want to just, you know, I could just sit here and live off a 20% pension and do nothing. So, but I'm not, my personality isn't like that. I have to have a challenge. I have to be doing something that's contributing to society and helping other people. You know, that's just my mentality. So I'm hoping that, you know, what we're doing will find cures for different diseases. Some of the stuff, like with the Russell's Vipers that we work with, the venom is used right now to do the test for lupus. So it helps people by getting a diagnosis.
Right.
So, you know, it benefits people, and that's kind of, it makes me feel good, you know, so it's something I like to do.
Now, I see, when looking through, like, the cost of snake venom, I noticed that Heloderma seems to be the most expensive at about $600 a gram. Anything in particular why that it's so expensive?
Heloderma is a lizard, and it is one of the venomous lizards, and it's the beaded lizard. There's the beaded lizard and the Gila monster. Like the really bad movie from years ago, the Gila monster. Which actually, in that movie, that wasn't a Gila monster. That was actually a beaded lizard, but that's beside the point. But the lizards do not have fangs like snakes. They have a venom gland in the lower jaw, and they have a grooved tooth. And they have to chew, and the pressure pushes the venom into saliva up through a groove in the tooth into what they're chewing into. So the reason it's expensive is they don't produce a lot. A lot of the more expensive venoms, you have to have lots of animals to produce the venom. And by doing that, you actually increase your cost, because you have to keep them alive and you have to house them. And, you know, I have to have workers' comp on the people who work for me, obviously, and stuff like that. So the more of those animals are around, that's why it's more expensive, because of the yield being so low.
Now, let me ask you, so where you work with the zoo, you said you don't take a profit from it, but is it a nonprofit type of zoo? Is it?
It's an institutional nonprofit, and I'm on the board of directors for the zoo. Actually, my wife is the director, and I'm the assistant director of the zoo. I don't do any of the paperwork, she does most of the PR and the public stuff now. I've gotten kind of tired of it.
Right.
Now, of all the times you got bent, is there anyone in particular where you sit back and said you made an extra out of the ordinary mistake, or is it all just one of those out of the whim, once in a lifetime chances that got you?
Yeah, they're all stupid mistakes. I mean, the one time I got bit by a king cobra, the snake itself, I had been gone and the heat had gone off and the snake had gotten the pneumonia, and I was treating it for the pneumonia. And when I was treating it, I was using one of the old garculators, the suction, to get stuff out of the lung. And when I was doing it, it slipped out of my hand and grabbed my hand. And it put me in the hospital and, you know, sent me into cardiac arrest. And I have the anti-venom here. I have all the antidotes, all the snakes we house here at the zoo. And unfortunately, the snake bit me and it died the next day. So that was unfortunate for the snake because I wasn't here to keep treating it. So, but that was a stupid mistake. And then the most recent really bad bite I had was about 3 years ago. And with the South American rattlesnakes, they have a high neurotoxic venom, and they have a tendency to thrash their bodies very violently. So what I'll do is run them up on an acrylic tube, and then I'll pin them when their head comes out the other side, and that controls the body and everything else. Well, we clean the acrylic tubes with bleach, and because of that, it degrades eventually. So normally I'll squeeze the tube to make sure it's not degrading because it's brittle. Well, I didn't do it that day, and it came sideways, cracked the tube, hit me with one thing in the wrist. I don't remember leaving the parking lot of the zoo.
Jeez.
The girl that was here, our head keeper of reptiles, she was driving me to meet the ambulance, and I collapsed on her, and she was punching me, trying to wake me up. I said, how many times do you get to punch your boss? And she met the ambulance. They put me in the ambulance. They claim, I don't remember any of this crap, they claim I woke up in the ambulance, told them how much anti-serum to give me, and to intubate me.
Jeez.
I don't remember any of that. I ended up waking up 8 hours later because I was over-breathing the respirator. My wife is flying to visit her stepmom in Maryland, and to fly from Kentucky anywhere, they send you always to Atlanta. So she was sitting in Atlanta. They called her and told her they didn't know if I was going to make it. So she comes back, and I wake up, you know, they're extubating me, and that's the next thing I remember. And then that was the longest I've been in the hospital for a bite, actually. I was bit on a Friday. I got out Sunday night, and I was scheduled to have the meniscus taken out of my left knee on that next Wednesday. And I called the doctor and talked him into doing the surgery anyway. And he said, normally I wouldn't take somebody who just came out of ICU. And I went into acute respiratory arrest twice. So once while intubated. So they, you know, he thought that might not be a good idea to have an elective surgery.
Yeah,
I figured
if I didn't get it done,
you know, I could heal up from both of them at the same time.
It's funny the way you're talking and all these injuries and crazy. I feel like the call to your wife just happens all the time. She's like, "All right, you know, I'll see you in the hospital."
Yeah,
can you wait? I'm in the checkout line.
Yeah. Let me finish what I'm doing.
She's pretty cool about it. I mean, you know, we've been approached by numerous reality TV producers and stuff, and we turned them down because they won't give us total control.
Right.
And the other thing they always want is one of them sent us a contract that says, we want conflict. Like, you want us to argue, you want Jersey Shore. And I said,
right.
It took me a long time to find somebody who would put up with my shit. Put up with my stuff. And, you know, for 15 minutes of fame, I'm not going to give her up.
Right.
If you don't want the reality, you know, I think my reality is as good as anybody else.
actual reality is more important.
No.
Plus, who wants to re-enter the dating field with, like, a couple fingers missing?
It doesn't go well.
No. Telling the same story over and over again. It's got to get old.
Yeah, it's old. Also, my nose has been broken so many times, it's not very attractive.
You're a real catch. You're a real catch.
Yep.
Now, out of curiosity, where do you guys get the snakes from? Are there donations, or does anybody ever show up with a bag saying, here you go?
Yeah, sometimes that happens. Our snakes come from different things. I've been breeding them for so long. I mean, I started breeding cobras back in the 70s. So I've got a blood. When Kristen does permits for shipping venom overseas, they have to do ascites, which is endangered species treaty. She has to prove lineage of everything. And so she always has about like 45 pages just for that species of, you know, lineage back to when they were first bred and all this other stuff. So we get snakes from other zoos. We breed them here. Sometimes we go and we actually collect them. You know, that's not that common for us to do, but we do it. If we need a new bloodline, sometimes we'll get permission from, some place to go and collect the snakes. We did, I proposed to Kristen on National Geographic while we were filming the National Geographic when we were hunting a snake on the island of St. Lucia that's only endemic to that island, a pit viper, Fertilance from St. Lucia. And that, you know, we got permission from that government to have them. We've bred them several times, and we're the only place off the island of St. Lucia that has permission to have them. And the reason we got them was to come up with an anti-venom that would save the people that were poor in the country from losing limbs or dying.
I'm noticing how you didn't say if she said yes or not.
Yeah, she said yes. The camera guy and the producer from that video goes, well, what would you have done if she said no? I said, well, nobody would have come off the mountain.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So the turning down reality shows because you have a girl that loves you like that you have made the right decision, my friend. And she said yes to you proposing while catching snakes. So I think you are.
Yeah.
I think you made the right decisions in life here.
Well, she handles snakes. I mean, she handles mambas and everything else. She's, you know, she works with them, and she got a master's degree in ecology. She just came back from India this last October. They flew her all the way to India to speak.
Oh, nice. So you guys do share complete common interest then, for sure.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah,
yeah. She likes to ride horses, and I like to punch people in the face. So.
All right. Well, do you, as far as that, do you still keep up with any kind of like training, kickboxing training, or MMA or anything like that?
I still do it, and I just, you know, I don't compete. Obviously, I'm 60 years old, but
right.
I just had my left hip replaced. Like it'll be 3 months. March the 10th.
What parts of you are left? What parts that you were born with are left?
Not much. the brain might still be there, part of it.
Sounds pretty good.
They did the hip replacement on a Monday morning. They started at 6 a.m. I left the hospital at 4 p.m. I never used crutches.
Wow.
The guy who did me was the guy who does the University of Kentucky's athletes. And he said that, you know, he gave me some limitations. I'm not allowed to kick the bag with any force until the bone is completely healed. And, but I started doing the splits within a week. So.
Peace. Yeah.
And then,
So, tell us a little bit more about the zoo and all. Like, I see here that there's school tours and all that. And I guess as a side question, what's more rewarding, seeing a little kid that's maybe a little scared of the snakes and holding on to them, or seeing some macho person acting like they're all tough and then freaking out when they see a gardener?
Well, I like kids. I like to see kids, and I like people who appreciate animals and stuff. You know, the guys that come in with the big blown up chests, I could care less. I mean, seen it, done it. I mean, it always seems like the big guys are pushing their girlfriends forward to touch the snake. You know, they're not doing it. They want their girlfriend to do it, but they're standing in the back acting brave. But I like talking to kids, and I like ones that when they're scared, they learn that to respect the animal. I don't like the idea that animals are used like a prop. You know, they're not a toy. They're not a prop. They're an animal. You know, they're not a demon. You know, they're an animal. You treat them with respect, and you're not going to get bit. You know, you handle them, or you do something to them that scares them, they're going to bite you. So you leave them alone. And so I really enjoy, you know, still enjoy educating kids. We do lots of school programs here at the zoo, and we actually go out to the schools and do programs also. So I think I enjoy that more than I do when I talk to physicians. We go from teaching kids about snakes to teaching physicians about how to treat snake bite or about snakes and venoms in general. So, you know, it's kind of a wide range of different audiences.
Oh, that's really cool. Now, one follow-up, as you talked about, you know, don't use snakes as props. So it was interesting. I watched one of the YouTube videos from the zoo, and they talked about there's never been a case of anybody dying in Kentucky from a poisonous snake except for people of religious groups and all. Have you met those people that do that?
I've met them. I've filmed with the BBC with them a couple times, but I knew them when I was a kid. I've lost, you know, a lot of them won't let me in the church anymore because I've testified against them in court. It wasn't about their religion that I testified. They were poaching animals and selling them, and that has nothing to do with their religion. You know, they believe what they believe, and the animals are actually very abused. If you watch the videos of them handling the snakes, a lot of times the snakes have broken backs. They're limp already and stuff. One of the times when they went in to raid them for selling them, we found a freezer full of timber rattlesnakes, probably 200 dead ones, frozen one big lump. Wow. And, you know, they'll tell you, I mean, they're honest about this. They'll tell you their snakes live a month to 6 months at the most. And that means they're not taking care of them because we have snakes here that are over 40 years old.
Wow.
So, you know, so the deaths in the state of Kentucky from snake bite have all been religious snake handlers. If they had been treated, they would have survived. Delay in treatment is one of the biggest problems with getting snake, you know, by treatment is if you don't get it in an appropriate amount of time, there's organ damage that can occur that's not reversible. Jeez. So the quicker you can get to medical care and get it taken care of, the better chance you have of survival.
Jim, it's really fascinating. Like, this is one of those interviews you know, we didn't know exactly what we were getting into, and we got into way more than we ever thought we could.
Well, hopefully you're getting something you enjoy out of it.
Oh, absolutely.
Not even sugarcoating it 1 ounce.
I mean, if you have any other body parts that you haven't told us that you lost, please chip in. But
I do have one little tip of my little finger of my hand, which is from a snake bite.
Yeah.
And that one became gaseous gangrene. I was actually having to sleep with it away from me because it stunk so bad. But it started to auto-amputate. So I went in and had a friend of mine who was a hand surgeon. He did a local, and they amputated it, and then I dissected it.
Jim.
I told you I have a dark sense of humor, man.
I love it. I mean, I'm thinking the whole time here, I'm like, you don't need a reality show. You need a book. That's what you need. You need to write a book.
Well, here's the thing about writing a book. Everybody keeps telling me to write a book.
You have no fingers to type?
I miss spaces. Well, I have no talent. I cannot write. Writing is a talent.
Autobiography, man. Autobiography.
Yeah, I need to find a writer. That's what I need to find. But, you know, it's somebody, you know, it's a talent. You know, just like you guys, you know, comedy is a talent. I don't have a talent. All I have is what I do.
Right.
So, yeah. You know.
I mean, you obviously have a talent to stay alive. That's a talent.
I'm a stubborn bastard.
I love it, man. So seriously, thank you for the time. I could talk to you for hours about some of the things you got going on, but I guess the best thing is if people wanted to check out either the zoo or some more information about you or some of the things you've done, where's the best place to go to kind of look some stuff up?
Well, you can Google Kentucky Reptiles and a lot of stuff comes up. Our website is Reptile Zoo. What's the website, Kristen? I don't even remember.
It's I got it up here. It's kyreptilezoo.org.
Okay. Yeah, that's the best one. I don't do that stuff, but right. I'm not on. We have a Facebook page for the zoo, but I don't have a Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, that's the best place to check us out. Is on Facebook. There's some YouTube videos. If you're morbid, you can go and there's one of my really bad bites where I had to pull gauze out of my hand. We have that up on YouTube. It's in three sections. It made one of the producers from Animal Planet faint.
Perfect.
Wow.
Yeah.
We'll tweet it out when this episode comes out.
It looked like somebody was starting a lawnmower. They're pulling this gauze out of my hand. It was like, it was an experience.
Love it. I love it.
Amazing.
Yep.
Well, we thank you for your time again, Jim. And, I mean, when the world ends, we know it'll just be cockroaches and you, because nothing's stopping you, apparently, from all these stories.
Yep. Hopefully I'll be around for a while. You guys get down to Kentucky, stop by and say hi.
That's awesome, man.
I might just do that, sir.
Okay, man. You guys take care.
Hey, take care.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, like that's a perfect example of like exactly what we said to him. You just never, you never know what you're going to get for good or for worse, right? Like, you know, we've had big names on here or whatever you want to call them, big names, or, you know, at least recognizable names. And afterwards we talk and be like, well, that was all right. It was pretty good. And then you get guys like Jim, who just have, we just unlocked like chapters of this guy's life story that are ridiculous.
Yeah, he has a life story where you give a 5-year-old too much candy and the kid just starts ripping off every thought that comes into his head.
Yeah.
And then he dealt with a king cobra. Oh, okay, then what did he do after that? They're like, well, he went down to South America to find him. Oh, did he get all the way down there?
Yeah.
No, there was a river down there, so he had to find a way on a boat. And then what did he do down there? He kickboxed.
Yeah, I love talking to eccentric people because it just makes my, you know, day-to-day a little, like, mundane, you know? Like, oh, yeah, okay, he went to work and he cooked dinner. He cooked chicken thighs tonight. This time he used a little bit extra paprika tonight. A little bit, you know? Like, extreme Scott. but yeah, that was cool, man. All right, Mike. I think it's time for another guest here. Who we got?
Today we got. We'll be talking to Scott Wilton. He is the vice president of the International Unicycling Foundation. He is a 6-time world champion unicyclist, and currently is a holder of 2 unicycle world records. And we're going to be talking to him about the Federation and unicycle road racing and mountain unicycling.
You ever rode a unicycle?
I have not. I'm not even really sure where to buy one. I guess that might be our first question, because I don't think they're readily available.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you can go these days. You can go right on like Amazon and get a unicycle. Let's see. Unicycle.
You think like a drone can pick up a unicycle and deliver it to my house?
Something tells me that you on a unicycle would be a disastrous scenario.
Oh, I would probably agree with you on that one, Scotty.
Mike, you get
fairly
one.
Fairly confident the results will not be outstanding.
The best seller is you can get one for like $70 on Amazon.
Well, that ain't bad.
Yeah.
Or, all right, I'll put down the $70. I'll go to the local Georgia mountains, and I'll let you know how it goes.
Or just lop the back wheel off of your bike.
Hmm. Yeah, but then it has handles and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. All right, so let's give Scott Wilton a call here. All right. First up, Scott, I want to thank you. Thank you so much for giving us a few minutes here on the show. And you definitely fall right into our prime categories of finding some very, very unique people who have very interesting hobbies. And I guess for you, it's gone a little beyond a hobby. But I guess I got to start. Are you currently on a unicycle?
I am not currently on a unicycle.
All right, disappointing.
I have definitely done hauls for work while riding. But at this moment, it's about 10 degrees outside, so it'd be hard to wear a hat and gloves and do a Skype call at the same time.
Sounds like excuses to me. Oh, hold on. Mike is muted. Hold on, what's going on here? Hold on, I think we lost Mike here. All right, hold on. I'm going to call you right back, Scott.
Okay.
Sorry.
Can you hear me?
There he is. Never mind.
Mike didn't want to talk to you. First it started on speaker, then it was on mute. So, I don't know.
Get the hint.
Darn Skype.
Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, it must be hard to be taking those calls on a unicycle considering the no-hands laws in most of these states, you know. It must be difficult to transfer over to a conference call or something.
You know, you do have your hands free compared to driving or riding a bike. You have both your hands available if you need to.
So, Scott, I mean, I guess we got to start right from the beginning and all. For what I've read up, you got a unicycle when you were 12 years old. Was that something that you were inspiring to get from people, or was that just a, oh, I didn't see this coming kind of gift?
It was a surprise gift. It was from my mom, and she gave it to me and my sister, along with one of those kind of balance board things. And she gave it to us because she had an old friend when she was younger who did it. And we were kids with lots of energy, and she thought it might be a fun challenge for us.
So about how long did it take for you to get the idea of how to ride it?
At first, I tried it right away in the beginning and didn't really have any idea what I was doing. And it sat around for a bit because I tried it and couldn't do it. And then a friend also got one, and his uncle, who was from out of town, can do it. He came into town, gave us some tips, and with some of his advice, we were able to at least get going and kind of exploded from there slowly.
Okay, talk to us about learning the skill of a unicycle here. Now, you know, a bike, you obviously have handlebars to grab onto, a second wheel on the ground. So what is the, like, you know, the whole falling down and getting back up kind of thing for unicycle? Is the key to try to bail and get off of it and get both feet on the ground? Or is there a lot more falling involved learning a unicycle?
In some ways, it's a lot like learning to ride a bike in that for a while it's hard and for a while you fall a lot. But it's different because when you come off, you always land on your feet for the most part. You have nothing to get caught up on. Like a bike, especially you think about mountain biking, if you crash on a bike, it's really easy to get tangled up in it. On a unicycle, because you don't have a frame that you're around or handlebars that you can flip over, that kind of thing, when you come off, most of the time you can land on your feet, especially when you're learning and not on bumpy terrain. But the main difference compared to a bike is when you're learning, the challenge is the front and back balance. On a bike, you have two wheels and all you have to worry about is staying on left and right. And on a unicycle, for the most part, you got the left and right down. Most people that are learning how to ride a unicycle can ride a bike. But it's that front and back balance that's the challenge.
So what do you have to build up initially when you're doing this? I'm trying to figure out, is it the core muscles you got to try to balance out, or is it more of a leg exercise when you're riding a unicycle?
It's a combination. I would say it's core. Most of your balance comes from your core, but you're using your legs a lot because it is a cycle. You use your legs to propel yourself, and your power comes from your legs. when you're getting on and off, you're using your legs. So it's a combination of both your legs and your core.
So when did it click? When did it click, like, that you were going to take this from this, you know, this little gift that you got, maybe something you, you know, you toyed around with in the backyard or when you had free time to, you know, actually taking this somewhat seriously and kind of becoming, you know, I guess at some point you had to become somewhat obsessed with it and you know, pushing a unicycle to the different territories that we don't ever think of them. When did it start to become an idea?
I don't know when the obsession itself necessarily started. I got pretty into it after I could ride. I started riding it to school and rode it to school most days. And really had a lot of fun with that. I started looking online. I was about 13, 14 looking online, trying to figure out what other people were doing. And I found out there's the North American Convention and Championships happens every year, every summer, and it moves around. And I'm from Wisconsin, and that was happening in Michigan that summer. So I asked my mom if we could go to the National Convention. And that was in 2007. I was 14 years old, and after going to that, that's when it really clicked. I saw all these people who were worlds better than I was, doing all these cool things, a lot of things I had never even imagined. And it was after seeing that that I really got inspired and really put a lot of time in, and it really went from there.
Now, was it hard, like, keeping all the chicks that were obviously like, oh my god, this unicycle guy is so hot, like, hard keeping them all away and staying focused on the unicycle task?
You know, being a middle school boy, I don't think any chick is into you, actually.
but that's kind of an interesting question. I mean, obviously we're going to get into your further going into sports and being a part of the foundation, but when you're starting it off, what is the reaction of the kids around your age? Is it, oh wow, this is cool? Is it, you know, kids are just jerks and they're like, oh, what are you doing on a unicycle? And all, because always that initial thought when I think of a unicycle is kind of, for lack of a better term, is like some juggler on it and all trying to show how much balance he has.
Sure, absolutely. So a lot of people's impression of unicycling, or their thought of unicycling or association, if they don't know anything about it, is with juggling or is with the circus or the performing arts. And the way that I approach unicycling and the way that a lot of my friends do it is more as a sport. And so especially as a middle schooler, but, you know, even in my daily life now when I do it, you have all sorts of reactions. You have the people who react with the, oh my gosh, that's so hard, that's so impressive. You have the people that react in a way that's like, oh, that dude's weird, he does that thing that's kind of funky. Just like the guy in Portland who, you know, he has his bagpipes, and now this guy in Madison is riding around with his unicycle. And you have people that don't know how to process what you're doing and get confused. So the reactions are all over the board. But when I was younger and when I was in school, I think I had a combination of people who thought it was kind of cool and something different, and then other people who definitely made fun of me for being the weird kid, as middle schoolers do.
Interesting.
Now, I'm noticing, looking at pictures of you, there's all different sizes, one, I'm noticing, of unicycles, but then I'm also noticing that there is, I don't know if you would call them handlebars, but an area to kind of grip, which looks like you're distance riding. What are the different varieties of like the unicycle? We think of the one that we see on, you know, in shows and whatnot, but it looks like there's a whole bunch of different things going on.
Sure. So just like you have tons of different bikes that are specific to the different activities, you have mountain bike, you have a road bike, you have your city bike. You'll have the same thing with unicycling. But because unicycles don't have gears in the normal sense, you also get your gearing from the size of the wheel. So the bigger the wheel is, the farther you go per revolution, the faster you go. So
right. The
one that you think about for a performance is a 20-inch wheel that's about the same size as a kid's bike has. And because that wheel is smaller, you can do tricks around it. Same way a BMX bike has small wheels. But you get, as you start going in the bigger wheels, the medium sized wheels, you know, a 26 inch or 29 inch is like a mountain bike. That one thing that's nice about that is we can use all bike technology, all the good tires that industry has developed, and use those off road. And then when we're doing distance riding, we have really big wheels in order to get that speed, because we don't have big gears like a bike does. It has those big wheels like penny farthings, those old school funky looking bicycles. And that allows us to go faster when we're on the road. We have the handlebars on there mostly for comfort, because when you're sitting on your butt or your crotch all day, just whether you're on a bike or you're on a unicycle, it's not that comfortable. Right. And so if you can put some of that weight into your arms, it's going to be more comfortable. And when you get really into racing, it does let you get into that aerodynamic position like you would on a road bike, at least to an extent.
So what is your sweet spot? Are you kind of a jack of all trades? Are you a distance guy, a trick guy, or are you just everything?
I have tried just about every discipline. I'm better at some than others, but my favorites and the ones that I do the best in are the road riding and the off-road riding. So mountain unicycling and road racing, kind of the more endurance-based ones. They have some skill in them, especially the off-road riding, but the focus is a lot on physical endurance and being challenged in that way, rather than necessarily can you do this trick and how much time you've put into learning those skills and that sort of thing.
So give us an idea of what a marathon race looks like. Is it something like the New York Marathon where we're going to have hundreds of people like on unicycles racing together? Is it more like sprints where you got like 8 or 9 people racing against each other? How's that go usually?
It depends on the event. There aren't a ton of unicycle competitions in general, but every summer there's the North American Championships where we get together. There's the World Championships, which is every 2 years and moves around, and that has a similar feel to a mini Olympics where you have all these different disciplines. It's in a different country every time, and you're competing with and against people from around the world. And, for example, in the World Championships, the winning times there are around 1.5 hours. So that's faster than the fastest runners will do it in. But the number of participants is less than in these giant city marathons. And you'll get packs of people about the same speed, maybe 3 to 5 people often that are working together and in the same way you would with bicycling and drafting and kind of racing off each other. In the smaller events, it ends up being more like a local town's marathon, maybe, in that most of the people are different speeds and it ends up spreading out, and maybe a couple people are competing back and forth that are about the same ability. So it really depends on the number of people, but it's not that different than a running race or a cycling race.
Interesting. So how long did it take you to train for to do your first event?
Well, so when I went to the North American competition the first time when I was 14, I read up about it and I signed up for the track races. So they're track races just like running. So you have your 400 meter, 800 meter, that sort of thing. And so at home, I went over to the school track and played around with it for a bit and also rode to school every day. And like some days really focused on going fast and that sort of thing. So if you're calling that my first competition, then I don't know how much specific training there was. But then some of my competitions as I've gotten older, I put a lot of time in and trained for a whole season coming up to it, just like you would any other big athletic event.
So now, like, flipping through pictures, I see, you know, like any sport, I see different brands and different, you know, companies behind this. When did you and how, well, I guess, is there any, like, money to be made in this sport? Or is it so niche and kind of brand new that you guys are kind of trying to figure out a way to do that?
There's not much money in it. It's really small. The people who run these brands and develop the brands are able to make a living from it, from the product, from selling it as a company.
Right.
They sponsor some of the athletes, but that is almost always a product sponsorship. So they give you a unicycle, so you're always on the latest equipment and that sort of thing. Maybe they'll help pay for a trip or a cool video project or that sort of thing. But the brand, the unicycling brands in the unicycle world doesn't have enough money to be giving any athletes cash or an income at all. There are people who make a living in performing for unicycling, and there are people who have done it with teaching unicycling or being kind of an adventure unicyclist and presenting it in the same way someone who is an adventure traveler might go around and do. speeches or talks at different places and make money from that as well.
Now, in looking at some of your races, like one that came to my attention was one in 2008 called Ride the Lobster, which it says it was an 800-kilometer international relay race. So, like, that, I can't even fathom doing that on a bike, let alone a unicycle and all, but what was that experience like?
That was a really cool experience. That's the only event like that of its kind that's ever happened. People always talk about trying to do something like that again, but it was a huge event to organize. But the idea was to try and create some sort of stage race for unicycling. Stage race, like the Tour de France is a stage race. You do it over multiple days and your times are added up to get your final result. I was still fairly new to the scene at that point. I got invited to be on a team with two other young Canadian riders from Toronto, and we ended up being the youngest team. I was 15 at the time. And that, what it was, it was 125 miles for 4 days. So Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday were each 125 miles. And it was a relay. So you would tag off. We each had a GPS, which effectively was your baton. And whoever was riding would be holding on to that. And that would record your data. And it would also could show where you were relative to other teams for the day. And it was up to the team to decide how they wanted to trade off. So you had a driver and a vehicle where everyone else would be in, and you could trade off every 3 miles if you wanted to, or you could trade off every 15 miles. And so you kind of would figure out with your team whether it worked better to trade off really frequent and do a lot of sprints, or go out for longer and really get in the groove and swap off. So that was a really, really cool race, but nothing like that's happened again. But you talk about doing that many miles. I've done a couple 24-hour cycling events. It was mostly bicyclists there, but a few unicyclists were there. And I did a 24-hour race, and the most I'd done was 213 miles wow. in one 24-hour period. and the world record for that is 284, I believe. Don't quote me on that, but somewhere around that number by a unicyclist from the UK, Sam Wakeling. He has the world record for that. And he was just riding on a track for 24 hours straight.
Man, what's going through your mind and all? Can you concentrate on anything else, or is it just like straight out, don't fall down?
So for just riding, I don't have to concentrate much at all. For me, it really is pretty similar to riding a bike. It feels really natural. I've been doing it for over 50% of my life in years. And so I feel really natural on a unicycle. I don't have to think about getting on. I don't think about staying upright. Your body really learns how to do that. But when I'm racing and I'm really going really hard, or I'm trying something challenging, then it does require all my focus. And that's one of the things I really like about it, is that it takes both mental and physical focus in order to do well.
So what's the future in this sport? I look at I've been looking at some pictures. I even see kids playing like almost kind of like a floor hockey, like a roller hockey kind of thing on unicycles. I see people doing mm-hmm. all sorts of extreme things. Over the years I've come across videos of people doing some amazing things on rocks and what is the future of this sport? And I know you have your hands in some unicycle leagues and whatnot. Where is this going?
So there's, like you said, there's a ton of different disciplines. At the World Championships, all of those different disciplines come together and are represented there. You have unicycle hockey, which is like floor hockey, and you have unicycle basketball. Those are team sport events. You have the track races, you have trick competitions, and you kind of have these urban directions. So you have flatland, which is like flatland BMX and street riding and skate parks and that sort of stuff. So that definitely has grown a lot over the last 10 years. And I think there's a lot of growth to continue there. It's really appealing to younger people because it's exciting and it's something that you can do with other people at the same time. It's very social. And you have your road riding, your off-road riding, and all sorts of stuff. So I can see it going in a lot of different directions. I can see different disciplines growing. It's really hard to know where it's going to go. I think it's always going to be a niche sport to an extent. I don't think it's ever going to explode because it does have a pretty high barrier to entry. You have to spend a fair amount of time failing before you can start to really go anywhere. And that is challenging, and especially if you don't have someone else near you or a group near you to help you out, that's always going to be challenging. So I don't think it's going to take over the world as much fun as that could be. But I do see a lot of potential for growth, and it's hard to say which of those disciplines necessarily have the broadest appeal.
Now, I've reading articles, I've seen you've been to Italy, Spain, Nepal, India, all over doing like the mountain unicycling and off-road racing and all. What do you think was the most like breathtaking view or most exciting thing that you saw doing this?
That's a tough question. One of the things I love about unicycling is the international community. And because it's a small sport, we get a chance to, if you go somewhere and there's someone else that does it, it's unique enough that you connect just based on that. And so I've gotten to travel a lot through unicycling that wouldn't have otherwise. Trips like Italy and Spain were for competitions. Nepal was for a tour with a group of unicyclists. We all met there and rode on a trail there on a trek. Using it as a way to see other cultures and experience other cultures is one of my favorite things. You don't have to be able to speak the same language in order to have like a little mini conversation. And so like an example is when we're in Nepal, we're up in these smaller villages and there are many people there that don't speak English or don't speak much English, but they're still able to come up and you're able to have a conversation through the unicycle as the medium. And so, you know, you can gesture with it, you can joke with it, you can give it to them and ask them if they want to ride without using any words. And it really creates at least a small connection with the people that you wouldn't be able to communicate with otherwise. So I don't know if that directly answered your question, but that's definitely one of my favorite things as part of this sport that's separate from me personal.
So I guess before we let you go, I got to ask you, have you ever had any like crazy injuries or crazy falls doing this thing?
I have. I broke my hand. I've broken a couple bones, and I broke my thumb one time bad enough that it was knocked out of place, and I had to get minor surgery in order to get it put back in place, and they put a little piece of metal in there. So I have a piece of metal in my body as a result of unicycling. I have friends that have hurt themselves pretty badly. My worst injuries have all been on the trail. And so doing mountain unicycling, coming off, landing weird in uneven terrain.
Right.
But one of the things that's nice about unicycling compared to some other sports is you're generally at a lower speed than you are, for example, mountain biking, where if you flip the bars, people are worried about breaking their neck rather than necessarily breaking their arm.
So let me ask you, me and Mike were talking right before we talked to you, like he's like, you know, we were joking around, like if you wanted to get a unicycle, so say someone was, you know, thinking about trying it, what is like one, like the entry level, like unicycle I'm seeing on like Amazon, there seems to be pretty affordable things, but two, what is the best way to like learn without like, say you didn't know anyone, you're living in the middle of nowhere and you just order this thing. Is there like a technique or something like that people should try?
As far as getting a unicycle, if you're in the U.S., unicycle.com sells unicycles. I haven't looked on Amazon myself personally.
Right.
There's a couple knockoff brands that you can get it and they'll work okay. But you can get a basic unicycle for $120, $130 that will last a decent amount of time, at least until you start doing harder stuff on unicycle.com. They're a retailer in the U.S. They're pretty much the main place in the U.S. to get it. And as far as tips to learn, everybody learns in a different way. And I think the biggest thing is persistence. So you can find lots of great tutorials online. Lots of people have different suggestions on how they learned on YouTube. The Unicycling Society of America, which is the national organization here in the U.S., has some tips on their website. But really, the key ingredient for learning how to unicycle is persisting, being okay with failure, and also being okay to step back, right? You're not going to learn it in a day anyway, so do it for an hour or two in that day and come back to it the next day. If you're able to find someone in your area, there's groups on Facebook to help you find people in your area. Just try and reach out and see what you can find. The internet's pretty cool that way.
One last question. I see you're the vice president of the International Unicycling Foundation. What exactly is your job entail? What's the foundation about?
So we're a nonprofit organization. We are the governing body for the sport of unicycling. We create the rule book. We decide where the world championships will be each year, and we do our best to foster growth in the sport throughout the world. We've supported some projects in countries that need a little more assistance. For example, we have some projects in Africa going on right now. And then we try and connect people with different resources. We have a lot of experience organizing events and hosting different things, and we know a lot of the unicyclists throughout the world, so we try and connect people together. It's a nonprofit. I'm a board member, so I'm not paid. No one else on the board is paid. It's all volunteer. So we're all doing what we can for this small sport.
That's awesome, man. First off, Scott, thanks for giving us some time here. You know, it's always cool to hear about these, you know, niche sports and whatnot. And do you ever ride on two wheels, or do you just find that like, eh, you know?
I do ride on two wheels. I think biking is a super practical way to get around town, and I get a lot of my groceries on a bike. So yeah, I'm not anti two wheels, but you'll find unicyclists out there that'll think it's the devil's work to put on another wheel.
Now, is a bicycle considered a unicycle with a training wheel?
I think so.
Well, there you go.
Scott, thanks so much. And if people want to go check you out or get more information, or you know, what's the best place to go check out the sport or get in contact with you?
YouTube's an awesome way to check out the sport. Shout out to some of my friends on there. Ryan Kremsotter is an awesome unicyclist who's got some really cool videos, but lots of cool stuff to check out with unicycling on YouTube. If you're in the U.S., Unicycling Society of America has some good tips in order to get started. And you can look my name up on YouTube or the internet and find some stuff about me as well.
Fantastic, man. And thanks so much, and good luck with growing the sport, and you seem like you're enjoying yourself, so awesome.
Absolutely. Thanks for your time.
Hey, bro, not bad. A snake milker. It's the Novocaine. It's just ruining my speech. Yeah. It's just, we had a snake milker who fought his way through paying for school and lost body parts. And we had a unicyclist. So, all in all, just another pretty casual week here on this here podcast.
Yeah, episode, we're keeping the norm around here.
236, Berlo. We're getting close to 300.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, even though that,
I guess, is the next milestone.
Yeah, I mean, even though that's you know, over a year away, you know, it's still like 50 seems like it was just yesterday when we were just goofing around and making a big deal out of 50. We have done five times that amount since. So
that's insane.
Yeah, yeah.
Put it that way, that's nuts.
Mm-hmm. What do you got?
Well, Scotty, did you hear about that baseball transaction a couple days ago?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The guy who's bringing a championship home to D.C.?
Yeah. Yeah, well, he said it, but he's in a different facility now. So
it'd be great if you guys played like the Nationals to get into the World Series, and he messed up royally, and then they went on to win the championship.
Yeah,
ah, the headlines would be great. Harper brings Nationals.
he didn't lie.
Yeah.
In that line.
Yeah, that insane, you're a Phillies fan, that whole $330 million contract.
13 years.
Yeah, see, I never care about the cash when it comes to my team. I don't give a crap. It's not my money. It's the years, man.
Well, I mean, he basically wanted to make sure wherever he went, that was the last stop. He didn't want to keep moving around. And the way I kind of look at it, if he can bring one or two series to Philadelphia, doesn't matter what happens at the end.
Yeah, for that contract,
get him with Trout still healthy.
Yeah, Trout. The Angels are going to lock him up. They're going to give him like $500 million, and that's going to be the end of it. But 13 years is insane. Okay, we've seen 10-year contracts that never work out. I mean, i.e. Albert Pujols, you know, like just, just, you know, like a representable player, American League player at these points. But, you know, it could be crippling to a team to have a like an albatross like that. And 13 years is so long. You never know what could happen tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like okay, so the Mets are, like, you know, at a point where DeGrom, like DeGrom, the best pitcher in the league last year, Cy Young, you know, top three pitchers in the league last year. You know, he's 30. Is he 32 now? No. He's got two more years. He's got this year and next year. You know, and obviously he wants a long-term deal. I mean, we're seeing, like, guys, like, even today, Severino, who the Yankees just locked up, 24 years old, just left the game in the middle of the game with shoulder discomfort. You know what that generally means for pitchers. That's a year and a half. We'll see you in two seasons, you know.
We love you. Here's a dead man's tendon. Put it in your arm.
Yeah. So here's a guy like DeGrom, you know. He's great. He's an amazing Met. I'm not in a rush to lock the guy up. We have the bargaining chips. The Mets got two, you know what I mean? Like, they got 2 years of this guy. Let's see, you know, how he is, and then lock him up. Like, so Harper, obviously he's a world-class talent. There's no denying that. Very good player, kind of a 5-tool player, can do just about anything. But 13 years, I mean, okay, so a couple things going his way would be your ballpark. So that's that swing isn't going to get old in that ballpark. So home run wise, he's going to be good. Outfield wise, he might get a couple more years because of the size of the outfield. So he might be able to play a better outfield.
DH likely eventually coming to the National League.
Yeah, see, that I wouldn't count on yet. Because we've heard this for a long time now. I know I keep saying it's closer and closer, but I wouldn't bank on that just yet. Just like I was thinking the same thing, like with the Mets with Robinson Cano, you know, like, hey, maybe they get 2 years out of him in the field, and then if, you know, the DH thing comes, then it's a good deal, because that guy's always going to have that sweet stroke, you know, like he's just, will he hold up? But 13 years, like, that guy can break a leg, snap a femur, you know, like, you never want that to happen, especially, like, say it happens, like, 2 or 3 years in, and you got 11 years to make up somehow. I don't know. Well, what are your reactions as a Philly fan?
I mean, I'm excited. I mean, obviously, he was the prime free agent candidate everybody was looking for. There was a lot of struggle to get him in, but we finally did it. I know he's good friends with Trout, and they keep talking about Trout being a South Jersey, Philadelphia guy, that he'll want to come back to Philly. So he lined up with Bryce Harper, Reese Hoskins, and Mike Trout. Could be a deadly combination in that ballpark.
I don't think Trout's going to be that easy. I think that whole playing at home thing is so over. What's the word I'm looking for? He's got to, like, sensationalized by the media. Mm-hmm. Like, one, it's hard to play at home. It just is. More attention, more family, more that. And these guys, listen, they get one, maybe two shots to ever make this kind of insane money. Like, they're going to go one. Depends. If they're going for a championship, they might go take a discount and go to, like, a Yankees or a Red Sox or something like that. Or they're going to go where, you know, where that contract comes. Look at Machado. He's not like, yay, I'm in San Diego. You know, he might
be. Yeah, he just went straight cash on me.
Yeah, I mean, argument could be for, you know, Harper, too. There was a lot of rumors he didn't want to go to Philly. But, you know, 13 years, who's ever going to turn that down?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the way I look at it. I think whoever was going to get him was going to have to do this kind of contract. I mean, in the end, yeah, once he gets 36, 37, you get a little worried. But like I said, in my opinion, as long as you get one, it paid for it.
Yeah.
That's my opinion on it. You get one parade down Broad Street.
Yeah,
you know, you just suck it up at the end.
I can agree with that. He's almost like you almost have to at least get one and at least get to another day. You're going to see like two generations of players go through his, you know, his contract.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing that worries me about him to me too is also two out of his last 3 years he's hit like 240, which is a little, you know, which is a little scary too because he's not old.
It's a little worrisome, but I think again I go back to since you got him for 13 years and you're trying to build a full lineup around it.
Here's the guy I think you guys should be jumping for. I think JT Realmuto is one of the best players in baseball. I wanted the Mets to pull the trigger on him, figure out a way to get him in there. That guy is a monster. He's just going to come to Philly, and that going from a Marlins ballpark, which is cavernous, to the Phillies, which is like, you know, a minor league field, you know, the size of it. Not only just home runs production-wise, I think that guy's going to really – I think he's going to be the fan favorite by halfway through the season. I think that guy's going to really change your team.
Well, we got a great lineup. We got a bunch of new people. And all. So why I brought them up is I want to welcome our new players by telling them about Philadelphia with some recent stories that happened in the Philadelphia area, Scotty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about, did you hear about the emu that was loose in Philadelphia for close to a year?
No.
Yes, an emu the size of a preteen child was spotted around New York County and even managed to escape a headlock and a potential captor earlier this week. Police aren't sure where the emu came from because they haven't received any recent reports of missing giant flightless birds in the area.
I feel like in Philly, it's just like, come here, emu, have a drink. Let's paint him. He's like an eagle. Fly, emu, fly.
Yeah, so at one point, officers and an emu wrangler managed to grab the bird by its wings and its neck. When they tried to lift the emu into the woman's pickup truck, the bird wriggled free and fled. North York County Regional Police say the large bird was caught Tuesday after residents spotted it walking through backyards and on the roadways.
I got questions, okay?
Yeah.
First off, you call in the emu wrangler. Okay, now, yes. This guy, okay, first off.
It was a lady.
Okay.
Don't be sexist.
This lady, okay, is she, my first question is, she is that her title? Or is she waiting around for years on end, like.
Why did I move to Philadelphia for this job?
No, like, maybe she's a ringer, like, we got to call her in, you know, we got to call in Janet.
It might be the opposite, where she took the title and it's like, oh, shit, there's an actual emu out there.
Yeah. So there's a couple angles to approach. Is she like, you know, she's got that red phone sitting in her, like, trailer. I just picture her in her trailer smoking cigarettes, watching reruns of some crappy show, and you just hear the phone rings, and her eyes kind of snap to the phone, be like, no way.
What do we do?
No way. Picks up the phone, Janet, yes? We need you in Philly, stat. And she's got to, like, put in some old uniform on, like, that she used in the 70s when, you know, emu sightings were rampant, and she's reliving her emu wrangling days.
She's making stuff up. She's, like, putting, like, liver pate in traps and all, hoping that the emu wants to eat that.
Now the second thought angle is, is she just saying she's an emu wrangler because she's able to wrangle a lot of other animals and she's just like, I need the work, give me the emu?
So you think the life goal was the emu and maybe she started with like smaller flightless birds?
Not that the life goal, but maybe she's just a general wrangler. Like she wrangles things all the time. Like, oh, there's a raccoon wrangler, blah, blah, blah. And she's just like, yeah, I'll take care of it. But please put down emu wrangler in the news story so I can add that to my resume.
So like she gives the card to police and they're like, raccoon wrangler. Oh, wait, that's the wrong card. Here you go.
Right. Exactly. You know, a new credit. Like, you know, like in comedy where you perform, you know, you could do an open mic at Caroline's, but you could be like, you've seen him at Caroline's. You know, like she could have just stood next to the emu and be like, you've seen her wrangling emus. Very specific, I'm sure. So, like, while you're doing that, I almost want to put, let's see what happened. Emu Wrangler Services. the first thing that comes up is Jeep Wrangler parts. nothing really popping up. This might
She's very specialized, Scott.
Right, this might be a network.
And Bryce, if you got enough money to find Emu, this woman will wrangle it for you if it gets loose. That's a key thing to remember here in Philly.
Yeah, I feel like in Philly, like the roaming Emu is a very small threat compared to like a lot of the other things that are around. So like I'd be like, eh.
Well, it's good to know. You don't want to look foolish and all. Like an Emu goes by, and you're like, what the hell is that? It's like, this guy ain't from around here.
Yeah, I think someone like probably just like kept him and was like hanging out with him during the week, but I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Let's see, another one here. A Philadelphia baker pleaded no contest in Montgomery County Courthouse this week for delivering THC-laced cookies to a baby shower back in 2016.
Oh.
The baker... Jamie Troxel of Troxie's Treats in South Philly was sentenced to 1 year probation on Friday for unintentionally mixing up dough containing THC with dough intended for the baby shower cookies in October 2016. The incident began when several attendees at the club in Springfield Township started feeling ill, and apparently a few even went to the hospital. Through blood tests, a few attendees found high levels of THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, in their blood. A later investigation found one of the partygoers said she could not feel her arms, and the room was spinning. After eating cookies delivered by Troxel, officials said 11 to 60 guests fell ill.
Okay. So, I'm looking at this a different way. Okay, so... Like, this weekend was my wife-to-be's bridal shower, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I dropped her off, and, I've seen a couple of these shower things before, and they look really boring. Like, a lot of people gathered around tables, playing stupid games, watching someone open presents. So I think this person was really just a good Samaritan. Mm. They were like, I know how boring those things can be. These brownies will make this shower a whole lot more interesting.
So maybe it's like he had the regular cookies in the van.
Right.
And he went inside and he's like, this is a bore fest. And he probably looked over at the husband-to-be. He's like, I got you, man.
Right.
Hold on. Don't eat those cookies. I got something for you.
Right. Everybody's tripping balls, opening presents, having a good time. That's a shower you'll never forget or never remember, either one. But I think he was just trying to do a good deed, and things just maybe went a little too far. Maybe if he lowered the potency to like people who are less experienced with edibles, they would have been all right. So, I see where he's coming from is what I'm saying.
So the judge is like, dude, half a batch.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's cool.
I mean, but
that's something to remember if you smoke ganja in Philly, Bryce Harper.
Yeah, no, that makes it more interesting, right? Imagine there was a table of cookies and you didn't know, some were hallucinogenic and some were just tasty. And you just play Russian roulette.
Cookie Russian roulette. I gotcha. Interesting.
Right. Exactly.
That was interesting. Well, let's go back to animals. How about a Quakertown woman was arrested Thursday for allegedly attempting to steal a kangaroo from a petting zoo, claiming that she owned the animal.
Wait, when did this happen?
This says was arrested Thursday. It was fairly recent.
Damn, I was in Quakertown a week and a half ago on a Saturday for a gig.
Oh.
Damn it.
Could have met kangaroo lady. Lauren J. McCutcheon. Maybe she's related to Andrew McCutcheon,
who's
also on the Phillies. But 52 has been charged with misdemeanor charges of theft by unlawfully taking and trespassing and a summary offense of damaging property. When police arrived, McCutcheon allegedly was found attempting to load the kangaroo into her Honda Pilot. I don't think those were made for those. But
you don't know the options you can get on that car. You can get power steering, Bluetooth, and a little kangaroo pouch in the back. You don't know.
So a pouch for the kangaroo pouch is what you're saying.
Right, like a little holding cell for a kangaroo in the back of the Pilot. You don't know. You're just saying you don't think.
Yeah, that's true. I apologize to our audience. McCutcheon claims she owns the animal and was going to drive it to Florida because a court order didn't allow her to keep it in Pennsylvania.
Huh.
So she's stealing it, and she's going on a road trip in a Honda Pilot with the kangaroo.
I mean, everyone needs a friend, man. Where did she get it from again?
She tried to steal it from, let's see, it was in Quakertown. I'm trying to find the zoo name.
Probably the VFW I performed.
Let's see. Matley and Peaceable Kingdom is what it's called.
Now, Mike, I feel like we're sitting here judging, but, you know, I feel like if you didn't have your dog and your cat, this might be something you might have done at one point in your life. Come here, kangaroo. We're going to go watch Phillies games together.
Yeah. She was probably going, because the Phillies were on a road trip, to play the Marlins. She was bringing her kangaroo with her.
Right. I mean, everybody needs companionship, whether it be, you know, a kangaroo or a wife. I mean, whatever.
Yeah. It's again, a free world, and we live in it. So
not only that, kangaroo was probably in some kind of crappy zoo. It obviously doesn't belong in Pennsylvania, so, I mean, this woman might have been doing a good job.
Come to think of it, out of curiosity, I mean, don't kangaroos, like, punch and stuff? That doesn't sound like a petting zoo type of animal.
Well, it's funny you say that, because the first image I got in my head was that big jacked kangaroo that the guy punched in the head, and the kangaroo was just like, just ate the punch and just looked at him and started punching back. I'm not messing with
those. Was that the one where he was saving his dog from attacking him?
That was one that I didn't think was real. And then I watched it a couple of times. I'm like, I think this is real. Like, it's too.
Yeah, that's manly, just running up to a kangaroo and punching in the face and saying, what you got?
Whatever.
Yeah. A little bit of a, it's not really a news story, but kind of like a ghost tale. Apparently, there's a ghost SEPTA bus.
Let's reconnect. You're bringing up again. All right.
Yeah, there's apparently a ghost SEPTA bus. Millions of people use the SEPTA transportation system in Philadelphia area to get wherever they need to go. According to legend, there is also a bus which appears only to those who truly need to leave their current circumstances.
Which is everyone in Philly.
But have no real destination in mind. This bus has been spotted all over the Philadelphia area, and according to legend, some ride it for years, only to eventually disembark right where they need to be.
Mike, these are just called homeless people. You just get on the bus, ride it for years, and then they get off when they get thrown out. That's where you're supposed to be.
Oh, so they feel a spirit, and all it is just the old veteran who doesn't have a home.
Correct. One time I was in Philadelphia, and I was, my ex lived in Philadelphia when we first started dating when she was in school, and I would go down there every once in a while and visit. And I'll never forget, I was, we were in, you know, not a great section, and we're driving past the clothes donation bins. And I see two guys breaking open the clothes donation bin and just stealing out of that. I was like, wow. That's pretty. I mean, I feel like if they just waited, they would have got those clothes anyway if they went to the right spot. But I guess they needed clothes that bad. I don't know.
Well, maybe they don't like filling out paperwork, Scott. That could be it.
Okay. Who does? Okay. Who does?
That is true. But, so Bryce Harper knows we do have a bus to take him to away games. That's a key thing. And finally, this one's a little old, but I love this story. Hitchbot, the cheerful hitchhiking robot that had made cross-country trips across Canada, the Netherlands, and Germany, and intended to travel across the United States as well. Instead, it survived all of 300 miles on the mean streets of the USA. And you can pretty much guess where it happened.
I've never heard this before.
Beginning its U.S. trip to Boston, the robot was vandalized in Philadelphia, the team overseeing the robot said in a statement. Hitchbot's trip came to an end last night in Philadelphia after having spent a little over 2 weeks hitchhiking and visiting sites in Boston, Salem, Lancaster, Marblehead, and New York City, the Hitchbot family said on their website. Unfortunately, Hitchbot was vandalized overnight in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Sometimes bad things happen to good robots. Even before the Philadelphia incident, the team was pleased with how people dealt with Hitchbot, often playful or thoughtfully. The team is waiting to get Hitchbot's remains back from Philadelphia and will then decide on its next path. In a statement, the family said that more is likely to come. And if you look up it on YouTube, you can... They had a video showing the guys punching this little
really?
Robot and breaking it up. Yes.
I know what I'm watching as soon as this this cast is over. Philly, man, sometimes I wonder if it's like now, like, that everybody knows how crazy they are. They're almost embracing their craziness just to be like, we ain't going to have no Hitchbot come to robot come through Philly. No way, you know, like...
Where you coming from, Hitchbot? Yeah. This is South Street.
You ain't from around here, boy. You know, like... But
you think Steakums is a cheesesteak, for God's sake. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's your town, Philadelphia.
Yep, enjoy it, Bryce. You're going to be here for 13 years.
Yeah.
But but sadly, you will have to get money from Bobby Bonilla because his contract goes 4 more years after yours ends.
Yeah, I've said it forever that Bobby Bonilla's agent should be in the Hall of Fame. His agent should get his own bust in the Hall of Fame.
The greatest move in sports history.
100%. Listen, even if it was like... $500,000 a year for 30. You're set for life. Like, you don't have to do anything if you don't want to. Like, if you live modestly and not like an idiot, you can live, you can be, you know, not even modestly, like, live just really well for a long time. Like, you don't have to do a thing. Bobby Bonilla is probably just sitting on the beach somewhere like, thanks, Mets, you know, like...
That. Yeah, that I think it's coming up in a couple weeks, Bobby Bonilla Day.
Well, I'd always like to get Bobby Bonilla on the podcast. He would be fascinating.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Why not? Yeah. We'll tell him we'll pay him $1 every year for the next 30 years.
Right.
That'll be our most expensive guest ever.
What are you talking about? You don't know that we pay all the guests in high radio fare, as we call it?
Oh, well, I've never been a part of the contract, so.
No.
you think I can ever get some of that sweet, sweet verbal shenanigans money?
Yeah, yeah. I think we're now operating at a a very negative cost at this point.
Oh.
All right. there was like one point where there was like 3 months of like, oh, well, made $50 this month. And then it was like, well, no. I'm joining the network, doing this, sponsors left. So, yeah, now it's just back to normal.
Ah.
But if you would like to sponsor us, guys, please reach on out. Yeah. We will push your product. It could be anything. It could be pot. What was it? Pot-laced cupcakes or brownies or something like that for your baby shower?
Yeah, we'll have to say shout out to Troxy's Treats in South Philadelphia.
This episode is brought to you by Nancy the Emu Wrangler. If you want to
got an emu in your neighborhood, really?
Don't get all emo about that emu because we got the woman for you.
Yeah. Sadly, we lost Hitchbot's sponsorship. I told him, just go down South Jersey, go through Delaware. But he didn't listen.
Scott's dent is tongue piercing after she goes out of business after this one. Well, anyway, I think it's about that time, Mike. I can feel my mouth a little bit more, so I'm kind of excited about that. And Mike, did you learn anything today on verbal shenanigans?
Sure did, Scotty. What I learned is, if you lose your finger, always make sure it arrives in the best parties possible.
Correct.
Correct. I learned, no matter how much you think a bike is cool and all, there's nothing cooler than somebody who could pull off a unicycle.
Okay. Yep.
And three, if the robots attempt to take over the world, we'll just have to send them to Philadelphia and we will be safe forever.
That's beautiful. Beautiful. I learned that snake milk does not do a body good because you generally do not have most of the parts you were born with.
True.
Burlo, anything to promote? Let's get on out of here.
Yeah, I'm going to promote one of our former guests, Alex Vincent. He has a podcast of his own called The Final Note Live with Alex Vincent. He does a lot of different interviews with people he knows in the music business and the entertainment business. Coming up this week, he'll be talking to Catherine Hicks, who played his mom in the original Child's Play movie. So that should be really interesting.
Yep.
So check it out on any of your podcast formats. That's The Final Note Live with Alex Vincent.
Awesome. And we had Alex Vincent on this year's Halloween episode, correct? Yeah, that was this.
That is correct. Yes, with Father Sebastian.
Father Sebastian, yes.
He should have gave you some nice fangs since you were in the dentist's office.
Yeah. I'll promote two things here. One of them is the next Tap House 15 Verbal Shenanigans comedy show. I did one the other night on my birthday, and it was awesome. I mean, 30-person waiting list. We might have some news soon. We might be expanding the amount of shows either on that night or spread out throughout the month. So that is with headliner Ted Daniels, a couple of new comics that they've done the show a couple of times, but Caitlin Murphy, never done Tap House, and then we have Josh Kincaid and Jimmy McDonald hosting this month. And then I had something else to promote, but I can't think of what it was. So, yes. I want to promote In Pursuit with John Walsh. It is... Essentially, it's kind of like America's Most Wanted, but on a new network. It's kind of evolved to more modern time, and that is on ID Discovery. So if you want to go check out the greats on ID Discovery, you're listening to one, Mike Burlew, who has been on ID Discovery, but also you could check out this guy, John Walsh. So go check that show out and give it some love. So, Mike, I guess that's it, man. Life is funny. Laugh at it and keep the old wind at your back. Till next week. Bye.
Plus, everybody, don't be like Scott.